Author Colin Woodard asks, what is our national story? From the very beginning, citizens of the United States of America differed in their view of what the country represented and what its national identity would be. Woodard traces the critical years in the development of our country in his new book, Union: The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. Woodard looks at the 19th century with its American expansionism, the debate over slavery, the Civil War and Reconstruction, through the stories of leading intellectual voices of its time. We learn how they shaped and indeed created the American myth, while also grappling with struggles that still haunt our country. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Union is released tomorrow. Its author joins us for Maine Calling today. That's next, but first, this news update. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Back in November of 2011, the very first Maine Calling show featured today's guest, Colin Woodard. He joined us then to discuss his book, American Nations, a history of the 11 rival regional cultures of North America. Today, he joins us to discuss his latest book. Its title, Union: The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. It's a pleasure to welcome Colin back to the show. Hi, Colin.
Hello. It's great to be back.
It's wonderful to have you today. Colin Woodard, a New York Times bestseller, finalist for a Pulitzer Prize, and a reporter at the Portland Press Herald. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you believe there is a distinctive American national identity? If so, how would you define it? Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Colin, first, congratulations. What an interesting read and so relevant today.
Unfortunately, it's true.
How did you decide to explore this notion of national identity? If there even is a unifying idea, what it is and what are its roots? Was it because of the division underway in our country right now?
Well, it went even deeper. I mean, the American Nations, the book that I spoke to you folks on in the inaugural edition of Maine Calling, was a book that argued that there had never been one America, but have always been several, and that the differences between the regional cultures in this country go back to the differences between the various colonial projects that formed on the eastern and southern rims of what's now the United States, that New England and the Chesapeake Tidewater region and the Appalachian Backcountry and the lowland deep south and so on and so forth were all places founded by entirely different groups of people with different political and religious goals, with different cultural symbols that mattered, that were building different societies. In other words, they were separate nations, and they wound up together in this awkward federation because of a shared external threat in the 1770s. But that said, that always had me wondering, you know, exactly when was it that we started, that we were convinced that we were otherwise, that we were actually a unified nation, that there was a United States nationality with its own origin story and purpose and definition, because clearly that happened at some point, even if it was wallpapering over deep and abiding fissures. And so that was what led me to what is now the book Union, is finding out the when, the where, and most interestingly, the who in the story and the struggle over creating almost from scratch a story of what the United States was supposed to be.
You end up tackling the entirety of the 19th century. Did you know that that was where you were headed when you started your research?
Well, from American Nations, what I thought was that the story had really come together of a unified United States after the Civil War, that the cataclysmic struggle, you know, with hundreds of thousands of lives lost, that it was the aftermath of that that had compelled Americans to want to come up with some sort of story that would hide the profound regional cultural differences that had led them into this war. So I thought the story was going to start in the, you know, late 1860s and early 1870s. But in diving in to do the research, I found out that nobody thought of themselves really as an American, or that there was a United States nationality. If you ask somebody in the 1820s and 1830s, what country you're from, they would say, I'm a Massachusettsian, you know, I'm a South Carolinian. The United States, nobody was quite sure what it was. Was it like, you know, the European Union today? Was it a treaty mechanism? Was it really a unified, you know, nation state? And if so, you know, what was its purpose and where did it come from? Because it hadn't existed very much earlier before. And it had to come into existence absent all of the ingredients that other countries had used in, say, Europe to create a national story, right? We had no single ethnicity. We had no unifying religion. We didn't have an exclusive language all our own because, you know, we shared the language with the people we just rebelled against. We couldn't imagine ourselves as living in occupying a mythic homeland since, you know, the mists of time had descended on the place because we'd arrived really recently and much of the home of the place had been taken from others. So there were none of the ingredients. So it was in the 1830s I discovered, as the revolutionary generation who remembered the shared struggle of independence was dying off, that the real crisis started hitting and people started getting highly motivated to come up with a story, that national security and the survival of the Federation was clearly at stake and there needed to be answers to the big questions, right? Who are we? You know, where did we come from and where are we going as a supposedly united peoples? And so that part surprised me. I didn't expect it would start quite as early as it did.
Well, of course, there are two overwhelming storylines of the 19th century, slavery, the Civil War and Reconstruction, which you mentioned, and also American expansionism. And you trace the thinking about these through a handful of prominent thinkers of the 1800s. One is Frederick Douglass, the former slave, newspaper man, and celebrated speaker, who I think most of our audience is familiar with. But right from the beginning of the book, we learn about two others who might not be so familiar, at least in the 21st century, but were in their day, George Bancroft and William Gilmore Sims. Tell us about them.
Yeah, they're the two who create, essentially, who first really package and draw together and put forth to a mass public each of the competing visions over what the United States would be defined as being. George Bancroft was was excessively a New Englander, you know, the descendant of early Puritans, the son of one of the most famous congregational ministers in New England at the time. He went to Phillips Exeter and Harvard, graduated from Harvard at 17 years old. He was a true New Englander. And the story he came up with for what the United States should be, a story which he disseminated in a wildly popular History of the United States that took him his entire lifetime, you know, 90 years to really put together an issue in 10 different volumes. But it was staggeringly popular, and it argued that the United States was, like the early Puritans, had been somehow anointed by God and Providence on a special mission to carry freedom's baton, to carry and lead humanity forward, both across this continent, but also into a higher state of freedom and liberty, and that it was theoretically open universally to all, that what drew Americans together was sharing in their commitment to the ideals set forth in the preamble to the Declaration of Independence about, you know, all humans being created equal and having inalienable rights, and including that of self-government and liberty and the pursuit of happiness. That it's sort of, if you will, our good national story or national myth.
The root of the idea of American exceptionalism.
Absolutely. And the root of it really going back to the 1630s with George Bancroft's Puritan ancestors, right? This is has parallels with New England ideas about the early Puritans being an Old Testament covenanted people tasked by God to create a more godly society in the American wilderness, right? George Bancroft was taking those same ideas, essentially, and applying them to the United States broadly. In fact, at the time he was doing this in the 1830s, he'd spent an enormous amount of time in Europe. He'd been sent by the president of Harvard to get one of the first PhDs an American had earned at one of the great German research universities, where he studied under some of the German thinkers who were coming up with Central Europe's ideas of nationality at the time. He studied under, Hegel and Herring and all of these figures. And so he brought a lot of ideas about what a nation was supposed to be, that they were organic entities that each had their own characteristics and would grow like a seed into a tree, and that ours was chosen for special purpose. So
Bancroft's contemporary is the Southerner William Gilmore Sims, who comes from very modest background. Tell us about him.
Yeah, he's the leading, now forgotten, but William Gilmore Sims was the leading man of letters in the antebellum South and in the Confederacy. He was a South Carolinian, and actually, like Bancroft, was born of little means, but rose up to become a major intellectual figure, a writer, a novelist. He was highly celebrated and a bestseller across the United States in the antebellum years. But he came up with a very much a distinct and competing idea about what the United States was. And it was an ethno-national definition. It was the Declaration of Independence's preamble is wrong. Humans are inherently unequal. You know, he's from the slaveholding South and believed that slavery was the way everything ought to be, and that in fact the United States was the homeland of the allegedly superior Anglo-Saxon race, and was a federation of organic nations that were separate, that South Carolina was a nation, that Massachusetts was a nation, but they all shared in this good Anglo-Saxon heritage, and that Anglo-Saxons should rule because they were the most fit, right? So it was what we would consider a white supremacist argument, even more tightly bound in that you had to be probably of the right religion and the right particular European ethnography to qualify to be a full citizen in his definition. But these two ideas appeared at almost the same time, and the battle over them in some ways continues today, but certainly continued all the way through the 19th and early 20th century in a very heated fashion.
Mm-hmm. And both were so influential because they were both authors and their books were bestsellers.
Oh, at that time, before the internet and television and mass communication, they were working with the most powerful medium available, which was oration. People used to go and attend speeches, and the speeches would be celebrated, and newspapers would publish the contents of the speeches, and other newspapers would see it and retweet it, so to speak, by republishing it. It was one of the main ways of disseminating ideas to a mass audience, and then you would sometimes put your speeches together into book form or write entirely original books, and that those were the two ways that you communicated with a mass public. And both Bancroft and William Gilmore Sims were major figures in that regard, in addition to being politically active as statesmen, especially George Bancroft, who would serve in the Polk administration as Minister of War and Minister of the Navy, and later be our ambassador to both London and Berlin, and take part in many of the decisions that allowed the United States to try to exercise its theories of being an exceptional nation.
You mentioned Sims, the Southerner, and his dedication to some sort of Anglo-Saxon race, but Bancroft believed in that too. And didn't that give his racism give others intellectual cover and New Englanders in particular?
It did. Well, Bancroft is perhaps less intellectually honest than Sims in the sense that he believed in he enunciated ideas that would in theory be universal and open to anybody, and it, often in his speeches he would be explicit that that was indeed the theory he was putting forward, but he also obviously had very strong racist ideas. I mean, his disinterest throughout his career and his writings and when he was a statesman in the major events going on in the struggle for civil rights in the late 19th century context was really quite amazing. I mean, it was a willfully ignoring even the existence of Frederick Douglass, who was a very difficult man to ignore. And so, yes, he was not somebody who himself upheld the ideals which he was enunciating. But the ideals are there, just like the Declaration of Independence's preamble has these soaring American ideals, even as its author, Thomas Jefferson, was keeping slaves and not keeping with those ideals at all. It's aspirational. It's unmet ideals. And Bancroft shows very much the hypocrisy and shortcomings and failures, and that he insisted that America had already achieved its ideals, that we were innocent and perfect already, and that our destiny was to remain so. And so that brings you a little bit later to Frederick Douglass, the former slave and orator and writer of enormous power, who took the ideals articulated by Bancroft and said, look, America is betraying these ideals every day. You haven't met them, and you Bancroft, are failing to defend them yourself. And that's why Douglass is such an important and pivotal figure in our history, is he's one who said, you know, if you care about these ideals, we're not meeting them, and we must. Whereas that was not something George Bancroft was ever going to do.
And talking about meeting ideals is so relevant today, Colin. I mean, this is the conversation going on right now as we see the Black Lives Matter movement across the country. And one thing that really struck me as so relevant today is Frederick Douglass's argument with the others in the abolition movement who were pacifists. And we're talking a long time ago, you know, almost 200 years ago or 150 years ago, as he's saying it can't be all pacifists and some violence is okay. We're having these mirrored conversations now.
Yeah, I mean, Douglass was discovered, so to speak. I mean, he escaped from slavery in Maryland and got away through the Underground Railway and the help of African-American activists and their allies to New Bedford, and was working as a day laborer, and was discovered by William Lloyd Garrison and his fellow abolitionists who were running the New England-wide abolition societies. And they found him and his incredible speaking ability and basically grabbed him and made him into their star. But the friction that grew as Douglass both matured as a speaker and in his ideas and started chafing against their insistence on not only pacifism, but being apolitical in the sense of not really participating in elections and not directly sort of attacking the system. Yeah, absolutely. There was an enormous gap that led to Douglass breaking away from them and led to later activists in the early 20th century, later in the story, the gap and the dissension within the movement about how, you know, strident to be, whether to go out in the streets or whether to, you know, try to cooperate with majority white American culture, which played out in the movement for decades to come. But yes, Douglass and the Garrisonists and the abolition movement definitely had a lot of tensions between them in terms of tactics and strategy.
A few more really leading thinkers of the 1800s, of course, in your book include Woodrow Wilson and Abraham Lincoln and others. But I'm really interested in a character I did not know about who is a Mainer, or at least a part-time Mainer. Tell us about Lorenzo Sabine.
Yeah, Lorenzo Sabine, I was amazed to discover in my research as I was, you know, learning about the trajectory of the battle over United States nationhood. And I knew Sabine, as many listeners may, as the 19th century historian of Eastport, Maine. You know, I'd read his great, you know, 300-page volume on the history of that area, and it's fantastic stuff. But it turns out that he ended up front and center as an accelerant or a catalyst for the events that led to the U.S. Civil War, because he wrote a provocative book review on a book about the Loyalists, those who'd remained loyal to the king in the Revolution. And one element in his writings was about how South Carolina and a lot of the southern states had far fewer people joining the Continental Army per capita. And this, and the arguments he had within his book, got picked up by William Gilmore Sims, who was furious that South Carolina's honor was being sullied in this fashion. And the back and forth between them ended up being parroted and played out on the U.S. Senate floor between Senator Sumner of Massachusetts and Senator Brooks, and then his relatives from South Carolina, that led to the brutal caning of Senator Sumner on the Senate floor, an event which in many ways was the symbolic foreshadowing of the Civil War itself. And they were essentially, the argument that preceded that was essentially quoting Lorenzo Sabine's book, and William Gilmore Sims' review was kind of the intellectual machinery, the ammunition that was being shot back and forth between them.
We're talking with author Colin Woodard about the whole idea of American identity. What is it that makes us an American? What makes the United States of America? His new book is called Union. Your questions and comments when we come back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Bangor Savings Bank, celebrating all the ways people all over Maine are making life a little better. Bangor.com/spreadkindness. And Andrucki & King, featuring Judy Andrucki, providing private mediation services in matters of family law. AndruckiLaw.com.
Welcome to Maine Public's This Is My Maine.
What's nice about living in a small town is that you can really make a difference. So the things that you do, people really appreciate and enjoy. And being a creative person, that's not always true. I can make a huge difference in other people's lives by the things that I do. I teach classes. I'm fortunate to live in and around so many creative people. It's really powerful. There's something about connecting with your community that is really important to me. I'm Mally Weber. I'm from Hollowell, and this is my Maine.
This Is My Maine is brought to you through the support of Eaton Peabody, the Maine Community Foundation, and the generous support of members like you. Thank you. Go to MainePublic.org to experience more of Maine Public's celebration of Maine's first 200 years. Happy birthday, Maine.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today we're discussing the idea of the American myth with best-selling author and Portland Press Herald reporter Colin Woodard. His new book, Union. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment to our Facebook page. We'll start with Ellery calling from Waterville. Hi, Ellery. Go ahead.
Yes, hello. Thank you very much for taking my call, because I've long been a fan of Colin's work. A quick comment. First, this expression about making America great again, I don't agree with that, because I think we've always been great, and part of that greatness has come from our character, our identity, and it's made us so. So I was wondering if Colin would be willing to speculate perhaps on some of the current trends, thoughts, as I mentioned earlier with Bancroft, some of the ideals and aspirations. If we're in the process of changing some of that to modify our character, our identification.
Well, I think we're there's always been a struggle, as I said, since the 1830s, since these ideas first happened, between the civic national definition of our country, that what holds Americans together despite the regional cultures and differences in our origins and everything else, what holds us together is fealty to a set of ideals in the Declaration of Independence, or this ethno-nationalist definition, which says, no, some subset of people, originally the Anglo-Saxon race and then later whites more broadly, however you define it, that some subset of people are the real people for whom the nation belongs, that it's really the homeland of them and that everyone else is a supporting actor to it. And those have been fought out ever since the beginning, and in fact, the ethno-nationalist perspective was triumphant in the 1910s and 1920s, actually became the dominant idea around which white Americans healed after the Civil War. So when we say we've always been great, there's been this unfortunate and horrific battle joined between these two ideas, which, you know, I frankly think the ethno-national idea is not only completely immoral and awful, but also in today's universe, completely impossible to implement. And so it's a dead end and a fool's errand, but its legacy is still with us. So when somebody says, you know, make America great again, you know, which definition were you looking back to is the real question. And we haven't always been, you know, if you believe in the civic national vision, which I think most of us do, if you go back in time, that vision wasn't always the dominant idea. You know, in Woodrow Wilson's administration, which is why Wilson shows up in this book, the ethno-national and white supremacist idea becomes absolutely dominant. You know, he resegregates the federal government, the government that had won the Civil War. He celebrates the first Hollywood blockbuster movie, a movie called Birth of a Nation, which celebrated the Ku Klux Klan as heroes for for stopping African Americans in the South from having political rights. They were the heroes of this epic film, and rightly, African Americans and their allies in cities all over the country were protesting, you know, parallels with today's events. They were protesting the screening of this horrific film outside movie theaters across the country. And at a critical moment, at a time period when the First Amendment was not thought to apply to the censorship of films, cities and municipalities and states censored theater productions and films for being obscene or having poor content all the time. At a time when the film was threatened to be banned by different authorities, Wilson actually allowed it to be filmed and screened in the White House. And the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court then showed it to the Supreme Court justices and various leaders of Congress the next day. The film was based on a book by one of Woodrow Wilson's friends and classmates, and the Supreme Court Justice was a former member of the Ku Klux Klan himself, and so was sympathetic to it. So, you know, there are great things in our civic national myth. The problem with saying we've always been great is we have never fully achieved those things, and at times we've been in a very, very bad place in regards to implementing and upholding them. So looking back as for a golden age where we were great is always a tricky thing because our history is so spotted in terms of how well we've upheld our ideals.
Ellery, thanks for your call. We're going to move to Port Clyde and John. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Hi. Yes. First, a couple of comments to Mr. Woodard. I have read all of your books, starting with The Lobster Coast, that I used at the Marshall Point Lighthouse to inform our visitors. I am a product of Massachusetts growing up and summering in Maine and now live in Minnesota, so I am definitely a Yankee-dom person. The question I have is I have three of the books here, 11 Nations, Lobster Coast, and American Character. I do take the 11 Nations with me as I drive around America, sort of looking for those clues of what makes someone from the far west who they are, or from the deep south, or from the left coast. And I have sent that book to friends in Seattle and Atlanta. So, and I will continue to do so as I meet people. My question is this. Is there a theme running through from Lobster Coast, 11 Nations, American Character, and the new book, Union? I'd like to know if you had a theme in mind that you might tie all those together.
Yeah, well, Lobster Coast was, you know, I'm from Maine, and I'd always been wondered why we are the way we are and different from many of the other places that I had lived in the United States after leaving Maine and, you know, going to college and living in other parts of the country later. So that was my first foray into colonial American history and this sort of approach to understanding our present through the backstory of the past. And, you know, I wanted to start with Maine, but it was in doing that project in I'd been a East European and Balkan historian and had been a foreign correspondent in Eastern Europe. I'd gone to Eastern Europe as an exchange student in 1989 as a college junior and then stayed through most of the 1990s. And that was my world. But Lobster Coast had me studying the colonial history of the country and realizing, you know, oh my gosh, you know, the different regions of the country were shared nothing in common. They never did. You know, where did we get this idea that it could be otherwise? And the story of Maine's relationship to Massachusetts even was very contrary to what I'd been taught when I'd been taking Maine history as a middle school student in North Franklin County. So that was kind of the background that got me thinking about American history and realizing basically the big talking points of American nations, that we've really been separate Americas. And once you realize that and know where the differences between the competing settlement bands that grew out of each of these colonial projects, these rival colonial projects, that you could see it reflected in today's events and the way people talk and predominant attitudes of different regions and political behavior and election maps at the county level. So American Character then asked, you know, one of the big questions that came out of it, people would, you know, I was writing a history in American Nations of to understand why our country is the way it is, much as Lobster Coast had been about why is Maine the way it is. And American Character was trying to answer the question, well, what is it that we've been fighting for and how could we ever cure that? And it essentially argues that the big struggle between our regional cultures has been between, boils down to a struggle between putting in defining freedom in individual terms as individual liberty and maximizing individual liberty and autonomy, or defining it in more communitarian terms of we are building a free community, and that that requires, you know, shared expenditures to build the infrastructure that allows humans to be free. And the tension between those things is the basically the fundamental subject of our biggest disagreements as a federation. And then you come to union, which is saying, okay, if all of this is true, how did we ever get the idea that we were a unitary nation, that we were one United States, and that Americans were somehow broadly the same, had the same, you know, shared history or culture, and where did that come from and when? Because it's a pretty amazing thing to take a balkanized federation with a history of a civil war and to be able to convince people of that. So that's the effort to understand the last piece of what has held us together all this time. And I guess the reason that I did Union in a certain sense American Character is I think that the United States as a federation is in medium-term peril, that we could come apart, and that that would be a bad thing, I think, for us and for the world. I mean, having been a Balkan historian and covered the aftermath in Bosnia and the ethnic wars in that region, you know, I don't have a bright view of the human condition, and I don't think it would end well. So if one cares about the United States and wanting us to stay together, those two books together are trying to provide the background and building materials to forge and readhere the United States together, both internally between its regions, and to relink us with the best of our ideals that, while we've never met them, are still powerful motivating forces and can be forces in a positive way in the world.
John, thanks for your call. I have an email here from David. I'd like to hear more about what American identity is and less about all the historical figures behind it. Colin, did you come to a conclusion? What is American identity?
Right. Well, that's the battle, right? There's the civic national tradition that says Americans are anyone who has fealty to these fundamental ideas about the unalienable rights of humans, that we're born with them, and a commitment to self-government and to liberty, and that that's universal and open to all. Or that other definition that, no, we're the homeland of some subset of the residents of the United States, be it the Anglo-Saxon race or white Christians or whatever it is, and that those battles have been going on for a long time. I think the former one is the one that I, as a Generation Xer, I grew up with that being the consensus and fundamental view, and that the older idea, you know, I'd grown up thinking it had been vanquished in the aftermath of the Civil War, or certainly in the civil rights struggle of the 1960s, but, you know, it wasn't. It's still out there. It's not a dominant view, but it's a powerful one that, you know, fundamentally we're seeing people protesting on the streets about the aftermath and the tension between those two worldviews, and the failure of vanquishing the ethno-nationalist one in our past. So, yeah, those are the two definitions. Do I think that we're people have tried to define the United States in the past as a homeland of the Anglo-Saxon race, and I definitely strongly disagree with that point of view, both as a historical fact at any time in our from our colonial settlement onwards, but also just as a sort of moral and ethical question. But that's part of our of the warts and all legacy of our country and its history.
One thing that struck me as I was reading the book, Colin, is I kept thinking it comes back to the one line in the Declaration of Independence, all men are created equal. We hold these truths to be self-evident. It seems like the national identity is a debate over that line.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Civil War was a debate over that line. And William Gilmore Sims and his His allies, James Henry Hammond and other thinkers, were attacking exactly those lines, denouncing them in essays that the preamble of the Declaration of Independence was wrong. They said so explicitly. So yes, that's a fundamental point of argument, because you could argue the Declaration of Independence was sort of, the United States being created, and the declaration of our values, with the Constitution coming later to sort of, create an operating system through which you might achieve some of those values. But the Declaration was sort of that early, before either the Articles of Confederation or the 1789 Constitution, that was the original statement of intent as to what, the American colonists thought they were doing. And we've been fighting over that declared intent ever since it was declared.
Mm. We're speaking with author Colin Woodard. His new book, out tomorrow, is Union: The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. We'll be right back. Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Dead River Company, committed to keeping Maine's homes and businesses warm and proud to be part of celebrating Maine's bicentennial. DeadRiver.com. Simply Sized Home, downsizing and moving management specialists serving Southern and Midcoast Maine. Learn more at simplysizedhome.com. And Maine Urgent Care, now offering virtual health care visits available daily from 9 to 7. Schedule online at maineurgentcare.com.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
The play The Private Secretary opened at the Lakewood Theater in Madison on June 15, 1901, making it America's first summer theater. A who's who of silent screen, Broadway, movies, and television have passed through the backstage door. The dressing room walls have been sealed to preserve the fading signatures of many of the actors and actresses. Among the signatures is that of John Travolta. At the height of his fame as Vinnie Barbarino on television's Welcome Back, Cotter, Travolta appeared in Bus Stop at the theater.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Thomaston Place Auction Galleries and Maine Maritime Museum. Happy birthday, Maine!
Some of the worst COVID-19 outbreaks in the U.S. have occurred at long-term care facilities. Part of the problem? Staffers who don't know they're infected.
They're moving from room to room with close patient contact. Certainly if they're not wearing any mask at all, there's a good chance that they're shedding the virus.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon between 4 and 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today we're discussing the idea of the American myth, or the American identity, with best-selling author and Portland Press Herald reporter Colin Woodard. His new book, Union. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post a comment to our Facebook page. An email here from Kevin, Colin. He asks, is it possible we are in the midst of redefining our identity and possibly recreating our country with a new ethic?
I mean, I think it's certainly possible. And I mean, we're definitely reexamining how we define ourselves and, finding ourselves wanting. Whether or not nation, any people, an imagined community of millions of people that we imagine we belong together as a nation, you almost always have to create your story that everyone is going to have as to how you define that community out of existing parts. There has to be some sort of tradition. You can modify it and update it and pivot from emphasizing one thing or another, but for it to succeed, history sort of shows us that you need to have been using elements, that exist in our past, that are part of our tradition and evoke things for people, which is why the content of our civic national tradition going back into the 18th and 19th centuries matters for whatever we try to create today, because it gives you legitimacy that you can point to different elements of whatever new model you're creating and say, you know, these things go back to the founders, or these things go back to early in our history, or these are things that we fought for and defined us as a people going back. Those, that longevity and those things matter. Whether they should or not is certainly up for debate, but as a practical matter in the way people think in their own heads about belonging and groups and attachments, those things have enormous value and power, which is why I think knowing about them is important, even if we're trying to create a very updated and revised definition of ourselves.
We're going to go to Stefano calling from Old Town. Hi, Stefano. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you very much. I wanted to find out what role did the market play in the construction of the national identity, and what about the free market principles?
I don't think in the people who were actually constructing it, it didn't play as large a role as you might think, in part because this was the 1830s, right? The country was only just becoming a national market for the first time. You know, the Erie Canal had just been built. You know, George Bancroft was one of the first passengers on it, in fact, traveling out to visit his in-laws, a bank they wanted to buy in a tiny town called Cleveland on the shores of Lake Ontario. As the country was just starting to get knit together, and we're still in a phase before real industrialization, and so those forces in the way that the individuals, you know, George Bancroft thought about it, weren't as large as you might think. I mean, in part because George Bancroft was very much an ivory tower, you know, thinker who probably didn't know very much about the economy. He liked soaring rhetoric and, you know, studying the philosophers and making ties back to German historicism and all that. William Gilmore Sims was, you know, coming out of South Carolina. He was born with few means, but ended up as a plantation slave lord. Obviously, if you're arguing for that slavery is a good thing and that a slaveocracy is a good thing and an unequal society and a republic are compatible, somewhere in there, there's a strong, you know, economic argument and incentive. You're defending an economic system that's built on enslaved labor. So, you know, that's an undeniable part of it for the story of ethno-nationalism and white supremacy that was brought forward by William Gilmore Sims and became, you know, the clash between those visions ended up being the clash of the Civil War. And when Abraham Lincoln was reasserting those ideas of civic nationalism in the Gettysburg Address, that's what makes the Gettysburg Address such a big deal, that the reason we're fighting the war is for these ideals and against that other one. So, yeah, I'd say the market and the economic forces were pretty clear in the ethno-national version, but not so much in the civic national one because of the time and the people who were creating it.
Stefano, thanks for your question. Going to go to Robert, who's calling from Parsons Field. Hi, Robert. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate it. Love all of Colin's work. I want to congratulate him for the series that he did on the Native American land deal in Maine. I've forgotten the title of it now, but that was brilliant. My question is about the idea of the importance of the frontier in the American character and Turner's theory about how the frontier played a role and what its current status is.
Robert, thank you for that question, because that is one of the luminaries in Colin's book that we haven't gotten to yet. Go for it, Colin.
Yes, I'm glad you asked that. You're setting up the next part of the interview just perfectly, so thank you for that. So Frederick Jackson Turner is one of the other main characters in this story for exactly the reason that you brought up. Essentially, Turner, you know, he's growing up during the Civil War. He's a young boy in what was essentially the frontier in western Wisconsin at the time. And he grew up and articulated a updated version, I would say, of the civic national myth. And the difference between him and Bancroft was generational. Turner was growing up in the late 19th century and doing much of his productive work at the turn of the 20th century. And at that time, scientific ideas, particularly those inspired by Darwin, were all of the rage. And having your getting your facts in order and also somehow tying it to these new ideas about how things evolve and adapt to their environments was very, very big. So what Turner did is he said that America had this is in a unique place and exceptional, but what made it exceptional is not that providence or God had tasked them with doing exceptional things, but rather a more science-based approach. That what had happened is when Americans went over the Appalachian Mountains into the West, that is what we call the Midwest today and later the West, and they were suddenly physically remote from more settled places and from the history and legacy of Europe, that out there in that new sort of, you know, that new Eden, that they were able to become Americans, that the environment around them led them to be egalitarian and democratic and virtuous and self-governing, then good Republicans, essentially. And once that happened, that was when Americans were created. And also that his native Midwest was not at the periphery of events, ignored by the professors like Bancroft, you know, at Harvard and Yale, who were writing the histories, but rather was central to the American experience, a regional corrective. Of course, he wrote this down in an essay form, the Frontier Thesis. He delivered the paper, which at the Chicago World's Fair at a special historical symposium. It was ignored at the time, but it pretty quickly went viral, as you might say in today's social media terms. It started being picked up by scholars everywhere and reprinted and discussed, and became massively influential. It got absorbed into history texts and the way history was taught and the way high school students learned it, and would affect the next 50 years of America's conception of itself. The funny thing is, though, that Turner himself, almost immediately after the essay came out, he started digging in to do, he loved research. He hated writing, procrastinated about writing. He only wrote like one original book in his entire career. But he really loved research. And as he dug into the research, he realized that he was wrong. There was something else at work, because he kept examining all the different settlers coming into the West, into the Midwest, and he discovered that they weren't behaving the same. They weren't becoming like each other. And then he started looking at detailed maps of, like, you know, soil types or climate or any factor he could possibly think of to explain the differentiation he was seeing in the way people behaved and their values and their and what parties they voted for and what policies they supported. And what he was getting at, and he kept researching this and hitting his head against a wall for the rest of his life, for decades, trying to write his magnum opus that would correct the Frontier Thesis, a book about America and its sections, its regions. In essence, you know, I didn't know about this until I wrote this book, but he was kind of trying to write American nations. He was realizing that the separate settlement streams out of New England and out of, the Tidewater and out of Appalachia, that those separate settlement cultures, as they moved into the West, evolved very differently. They came with different attitudes into the same environment, and those things stuck. And so that's kind of one of the – it was sort of a very powerful idea that even its author started realizing wasn't quite correct after he'd written down the early version of it. But, he was sort of like a one-hit wonder in a certain sense, where he wrote this number one, you know, best-selling song that everyone listens to, and nobody would hear any of his new stuff when he tried to go out in concert. Everyone just wanted to hear that again. So it was it stuck in the American consciousness.
Robert, thanks for your call. We're going to move on to Marfine in Portland. Hi, Marfine. Go ahead.
Hi, yes. The title Union is an interesting title given today's context, with the Confederate statues being toppled and flags being torn down. You also spoke about myths. Maine is sort of has a myth that we aren't racist because we were a free state, founded as a free state, and Chamberlain and the Civil War and whatnot. So I wanted your take. You know, in Maine, we see Confederate flags flying around. I wanted your take on sort of the strains that we see in Maine reflecting things like that in the Confederate flags and statues and whatnot.
Yeah, I mean, increasingly in the internet age, you know, all politics is national, you know, right? Things that localized events. People's attitudes are starting to become more and more influenced by what cable news programs they watch and what Facebook decides they'll be most likely to, you know, respond and engage with, because it brings eyeballs, which brings advertisers. So everybody is starting to live in separate information bubbles, that we get our information not so much from the newspaper that, you know, your local newspaper that shows up at your general store, your conversations you have there, but rather from these separate bifurcated feeds. And as that happens, you start seeing a sort of transformation of a lot of symbols and shorthands for different ideas. I mean, when I was growing up in the 70s and 80s in North Franklin County, I mean, there was very little country music, right? And now you can drive almost anywhere in rural Maine, and country music stations are huge. Also, the Confederate flag. You never saw the Confederate flag, or very, very rarely, when I was a kid. And now it's out there as some kind of shorthand for individual liberty, at least. So those are all things that have come more recently. That's not to say, you know, I would never have made the argument that Maine is, you know, is somehow immune from racism. And that's a problem that exists in all of our regional cultures and has been a curse, you know, for our society since the beginning. It's just the differences between whether or not you have a regional culture that was designed and engineered entirely around the institution of slavery or not. That means that racism, as it was held in practice and the way it would be applied, worked very differently in different regions of the country based on their legacies. But you're seeing the nationalization of various symbols nowadays.
Morphine, thanks for your question. Colin, I know we just have a minute or two left, and I wanted to ask you this. I mentioned that your book comes out tomorrow. Because of COVID-19, I suspect you don't have a traditional book tour. What happens for you tomorrow when it hits bookstore shelves?
Well, the good folks at Longfellow Books in Portland were going to be my hosting the launch event, and we have gone virtual, as many places and institutions have in the age of the pandemic. So the Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance and Longfellow Books are holding a virtual event tomorrow night at 7 p.m. I'll be speaking about the book via Zoom, a big mass Zoom. Anybody can Google either of those institutions or my website and find your way to the Zoom link. And I believe you can order from Longfellow Books in real time online. You can send them requests if you want it, the book signed or signed to a particular person and personalized. And the next day I'll be signing all of the custom stock so that Longfellows can mail it out to customers. So it's the next best thing to actually being there. So anyone who wants to join, you're well invited. And there will be other virtual events taking place with other institutions around the country, which, of course, being virtual, will be open to everybody, that I'll post on my website going forward.
Well, Colin, thanks so much for joining us today, and congratulations. Colin Woodard, a New York Times bestselling author and reporter for the Portland Press Herald. His new book is Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United States Nationhood. Nikki Shields ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Stay tuned for today's CDC briefing with Director Nirav Shah. You can also watch that briefing on Maine Public Television or on our website. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.